We scaled to around 45 people really quickly. And in my opinion, we actually scaled way too fast. Going through that ride of sort of hiring, moving really fast, really great energy around the business to let go of people has been really, really tough.
I don't know any founder really that hasn't had to go through the nightmare that is firing people.
Yeah, it's fucking tricky. Probably one of the worst parts of the job. I actually remember the first time I had to do it, and it's maybe a little bit embarrassing, but I actually cried.
My friend, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
I have been looking forward to this for a long time. As soon as I decided that I was going to be making this sort of content, you were one of the first people that came to mind.
Amazing. Honored.
I start all of these interviews not by introducing people, because
nice.
I found...
I'm boring.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I give, just give us the knowledge and the wisdom. I don't care about who you are. No, mainly because when people have introduced me in the past, I felt like they miss out more relevant piece of information or maybe more recent piece of information. So actually... I ask people to introduce themselves. So, what should people know about you? Who is the infamous Dan Hogan?
Well, thank you very much for having me, mate. Yeah, really excited to have a chat. And I am Dan Hogan. I'm the co-founder of Ember, an automated accounting and tax platform. But that's not who I am. So, I am an Aussie. Hailing from Melbourne, back in Australia, down south. I now live in London. I've been living here for about 7 years, but I definitely would still call Australia home. I'm losing the accent every year that goes by, but I would say my superpower in life and in business is by actually being able to help others and bring people along for a journey, which I think is what you need to be able to do in a startup. And that's really... I think where I bring, or what I bring to the party when it comes to the business and life in general. I just love having these types of conversations. So I'm really excited to have it, especially with you.
Oh, honored. Do you want to tell people how we met as well?
I can. Yeah, I'm actually heading back there next week for our offsite.
Yeah.
So yeah, for everybody listening at home, AJ and I met at the founders retreat that was run up in West Lexham, May a few years ago now. And that's where we met. So yeah, we had an amazing retreat. I think my first impressions of you were quite interesting, I think. I remember actually getting on a Zoom call prior to the founders retreat, and I didn't have that kind of depth perception of actually how tall you are. And seeing you on camera, I was like, this dude looks super young. And he's the CEO of Founders. What's going on here? And then I was a little bit skeptical actually of Founders at the start before I came. And it was one of those things, you know, when you're like so busy at work and you tell yourself, you're like, oh, I don't know if I'm going to even be able to make it this weekend. And I was just like, there was something that just said, like, don't be that person, don't do it again, and just really give yourself over. And I honestly, like, couldn't have thought of anything better, because I've met you and you've now entered into my life, and we've been, yeah, amazing friends over the last few years, having lived together now as well. So a few stories to share there. But yeah, it literally changed the course of my life because I met yourself. And I also met my girlfriend within the community as well later on. So it was one of those real sort of seminal moments of my life, because I felt as though my community was potentially waning a little bit in the UK. All my Aussie mates had gone back home, and I was really looking for that replacement. And I definitely have found it in this community, in you, and in the people that sort of make it up. So yeah, amazing stuff.
That is so heartwarming. And I think I like telling your story when it comes to the power of founders, because that retreat also changed my life. I mean, we ended up living together. We've been like really tight ever since, and seen each other go through tough times.
Yeah, for sure.
yeah. bonded over breakups. That was a seminal moment. So I'd love to first, I mean, A, we'll start off by giving people context of Ember because it's amazing and the service is just long overdue. Like it just makes so much sense.
Yeah, for sure.
Let's talk about Ember and then specifically how you have built in processes for managing people, especially in a remote first world, and then what you've learned along the journey in that regard. So tell us a bit about Ember. What do you guys do?
Sure.
And where have you got to in the startup journey?
Yeah, definitely. So it's been a bumpy one, that's for sure. And I think as anything good in life, there's always been a decent amount of ups, but a lot of downs at the same time over the last 5 years. So we are essentially an automated accounting and tax platform. We're trying to replace the accountant from the value chain, something that I know a lot of startups hate. What we're trying to do essentially is ensure that business owners are no longer spending any time on their financial admin. So at the moment, there's just a massive time sink. We've done a few studies. We found that the average business owner spends around 15 hours a week on financial admin. And when you actually put that into context, it's just like, what the hell? Why are they spending so much time on doing things like running payroll, categorizing their transactions, collecting receipts, all of the shit that you just don't want to do as a business? So the real sort of key thing when Aaron and I actually met, and I'll take you into the story about Aaron and I actually meeting because it's an interesting one. So Aaron, my co-founder, is an amazing person. He's a Northern Irishman. So there's a Northern Irishman and an Australian running a business in London. It's always the butt of a joke whenever we go into fundraising. If they can actually understand us whenever we pronounce Ember and Aaron Amber. But around about 5 years ago, Aaron and myself were both on quite different paths. Aaron was an IT consultant. So he'd actually started up his own business. He was consulting for the likes of Google, Red Bull at the time. And he just got so frustrated being an IT consultant himself and running his own business with the accounting that went alongside. He just didn't understand why there was so much time being spent in this, and having experienced the pain and frustration firsthand, just thought this could be made so much easier for guys like himself. So he actually quit the IT business, moved into a WeWork, and that's where we met. So we are one of those WeWork success stories that they purport to have actually happened. And I at the time was running a different finance software company that I'd grown to a decent amount in the UK, but knew that it wasn't the future of accounting and tax. It was a really manual, archaic product that was very much so perpetuating the very real and necessary evil of the accountant in the value chain. And I actually remember Aaron, the day he walked into the dedicated desk area we were working in, he sat down, typical software engineer, headphones on, didn't speak to anyone, head in the code. And me being the sort of extrovert that I am was like, who's this dude sitting over in the corner? I feel quite bad that no one's speaking to him. So it was actually coming up to the end of 2018 and Christmas time. And he moved in around October, still probably hadn't talked to anybody until sort of early December. And I was like, we should really invite this dude to the Christmas party. I feel quite sorry for him. So I went over, I was like, mate, do you want to come to the Christmas party this year? He's like, yeah, perfect. Sounds good.
Whose Christmas party?
The WeWork Christmas party, actually, that was being run that year. Back in the days where WeWork was like at its height, we were like
giving away champagne.
Honestly, there were some nights we'd be in WeWork till 3 a.m. just on the Prosecco taps.
I love that.
playing table tennis. It was outrageous. And so we invited him along to the Christmas party. And at the Christmas party, as you do at a Christmas party, we got into the topic of accounting and tax. And you could just see the, like, it was like Moses and the, like, sea parting around us. But we were chatting about accounting and the future of open banking and machine learning at the time, because Aaron's a bit of an expert in machine learning. And everything was just sort of coming together at the right time. And another thing called Making Tax Digital, where HMRC are becoming an API-first organization and opening up their infrastructure to the likes of us to help you guys file your taxes. A lot more streamlined in a digital world. And the convergence of these three main shifts just meant that this was the perfect time to start. And Aaron and I then formed the company early 2019, and we pretty much built the entire thing ourselves, just he and I in the early days. So him, the software engineer, myself, the accountant. And that kind of synergy that you have when you're with one person in one room, being able to just build an entire product is honestly magical. And that's where we found ourselves in the early days. So we built an entire product, and then we were able to get it into market and did our first funding round. And we've been on a bit of a funding journey ever since. So we have been through the pre-seed, the seed, the seed extension, and now the seed two. So we made the joke. There's not going to be a seed three. So this is it.
Well, it was a healthy seed two, but we'll get onto that in a bit. I'd love to know. So you met really December 18.
Yeah.
And you started the company early 19.
Yeah.
How did you know if he really loved you? Like, how do you go about getting into this marriage, which really you spend more time with your co-founder than you do with anyone else in life, really, when you are building a company in the early stages, especially? How did you think through, like, this guy? Like, intuitively, I'm sure you're like, we feel value aligned. He seems like a lovely guy. He seems down to earth. He seems like honest and trustworthy. Is that enough? Like, how do you go through figuring out who's the right co-founder for you?
It's a really good question. And I feel like I have been so lucky with Aaron, because I've heard some horror stories between other co-founders, founders who have started businesses, who have known each other really well prior and then gone into business together and it just hasn't worked. And not knowing Aaron, obviously, for my entire life, and now having spent the last 5 years with him, we are the perfect match from every sense of the word, I think. And the reason being that, like, we just complement each other in really great areas, but we also challenge each other. And I think one of the most important things is not to have a yes relationship, like always to have no relationship where you actually challenge each other on certain aspects. And I think that's where that healthy tension has enabled us to really propel the business, because we don't always see eye to eye. I mean, Aaron is the biggest optimist I think I've ever met in my life, and I am an accountant. And what comes alongside that is pragmatism and making sure that everything checks and balances. So that kind of tension where Aaron's just like, let's do the most lofty thing, let's do the visionary thing, and me really bringing him back down on that sort of journey and being able to actually put it into process is where we've really gelled amazingly. And I really do think we've just been extremely lucky. And now he's become pretty much one of my best mates. And I definitely say that, he'd be up there when I get married sort of thing. So he's just an amazing dude, and he's an absolute workhorse. One of the most intelligent people that I've ever met as well. And I think that's where also we complement each other, because I obviously would say that I'm intelligent to an extent, but not to that level. And I feel like what I can do, though, is help him actually convey a lot of his messages to people in words and in spoken word, because he's a software engineer. He really focuses quite a lot on documentation and written word. When it comes to actually conveying that message to people, you really need to be able to soften a lot of the messages and get that point across succinctly, but really inspiringly as well. So I think that's what I definitely bring to the table. And that's why I actually own a lot of the fundraising conversations. So between ourselves, I actually own the fundraising journey, and he helps put all the documentation together in the background. And it's a really amazing sort of thing to be able to also be as comfortable as you are in your positions, to know that, like, historically the roles of a CEO and a COO, because for instance, I am the COO, so I'm not actually the CEO of Ember. And although I historically have done a lot of the things that, say, a CEO would do, our division of powers are just quite different in that way. And because I do own a lot of the fundraising conversations, sometimes investors are like, well, why am I speaking to the COO, not the CEO? And it's like, well, this is just how it works. This is our division of labor. This is our division of powers. We've really understood what we are both good at. And I think that is the most important part, obviously, is really being open about what you're good at and being open about what you're not good at, and being able to just align on those set of responsibilities to move forward.
That was a really rich explanation. Thank you. Do you work on your relationship together at all, proactively?
Yeah, I think we have historically. I don't think we're the best at it. I think we do have check-ins quite regularly, but
relationship check-ins.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. Relationship check-ins. And I think what we are really good at is being able to give each other frank feedback. I don't think we skirt around the edges at all. I remember this one time, actually, Aaron was presenting at an all hands, and he thought it was just a really big hack to basically put the presentation together and then just read all the words on the presentation. And that was it. And I was like, mate, I think it'd be better actually not to read the words from the presentation and to present it as if it was, say, a story, or just have a slide where you've got a picture and then you take people through a story and a journey about what you're trying to convey rather than just reading from the slide. Because honestly, that last presentation, I could almost see people falling asleep. And he took it on board and he said, I promise the next time we do an all hands, I'm just going to have one slide. And the next time we did all hands, he had this one slide and he actually talked about the Stripe beginnings and the story about Stripe early on, which is really interesting. And people were just so much more engaged, and he's obviously grown from that piece of feedback. And I think the ability to give that in real time and without any filters is the most important part of being a functioning co-founder, of having a functioning co-founder relationship.
Do you have a story of where he's given you feedback and it's made a big impact on you?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So he actually told me that I should be focusing on the higher leverage, more important things than the real small nitty gritty. I have a tendency to actually weight towards perfectionism and trying to do something that might not have a big impact. Say, for instance, like something admin based or something that is in the background, has to be done, but shouldn't be done by me. And he really actually focused a lot of my time. He said, you should be spending 80% of your time on the things that will actually have a bigger impact, and just wait towards, because the position that you're in, you need to have a bigger impact on the bigger picture rather than the sort of minutiae of what's happening within the business. To forfeit that control to other people and make sure that you're actually just spending time on things that are actually going to make an outsized impact rather than just those really small details. And also a really interesting thing he's taught me is that this philosophy of everything is always draft. I've always wanted to have something that goes straight into finished product and then like that's it. And like that's why like my perfectionism plays well into that. But at the end of the day, it should always be draft, and it should always be open to interpretation and open to change. And I think that's something that I now really live by, is that no matter what you produce, everything is always draft. It can be open to somebody giving you feedback on that and changing and moving directions in the future, because really that's how businesses survive. That's how startups survive. It's just a game of who can stick around the longest and land on something that is going to take you off. So I think that's another really interesting learning he's taught me.
I love that. I feel like the art of feedback and communication is such a nuanced and tricky one, and I can definitely attest to you being a fantastic communicator outside of the business as well as within it. So one thing I know is that you, Ember, has gone from being, was it entirely in person to then entirely remote to then trying to come back into the office and figuring out a hybrid model, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we are victims of COVID.
Communication obviously becomes so much more difficult when you're not sitting next to the people you're working with, the people on the team. Have you come up with any frameworks or approaches as to how you ensure that it doesn't suffer when people went from going in person in the office to remote?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's a lot in that actually. And I think where I'll start is where we essentially started as a business, which was Aaron and I met in person at a WeWork. And we had that magic that happens when you work with somebody in person. And we were able to build and ship so quickly, probably too quickly. And a lot of our developers have said whatever Aaron developed was just spaghetti code, but and they've just spent the last 3 years rebuilding it, but it's okay. And that magic that happens in person is almost irreplaceable. We then went through COVID. Aaron and I were working at home And we were obviously just completely remote. We then hired during COVID. We hired people from all around the UK. We hired some people across Europe. And we are now in this position where essentially we are a completely remote business where we have people all around the UK. And it's pretty much just Aaron and I in the office. And that transition from two people who love being in the office to hiring people that love being at home and do their best work at home, the biggest thing for us has been this piece of communication. And we've been trying to work out what the best way to make sure everybody is up to speed is. And I think the one thing that actually really like stood out to me, I've been reading this book called Scaling People by Claire Hughes Johnson, who's the CEO of Stripe, or the ex-CEO of Stripe. She is an incredible person. And I think one of the things that she said that really resonated with me was around this notion of, say, you wanted to go and play football at the park, or you wanted to go and play whatever it is, lacrosse, and you bring a heap of equipment to the park and you get everyone to turn up. You turn up and then there are no rules for the game. There's no way to win. There's no sort of structure in place to help you play this game. What do you have? You just have a bunch of people like running around, probably kicking a football, not knowing what they're doing and not knowing how to win, or not knowing how to beat their opposition, or not knowing who the competition is. So the whole point of this is that we need processes and systems and documentation and communication in place so that people know what game they're playing. They know how to win. And if you don't have that whilst you scale a business, it's really, really hard to keep people aligned, keep people autonomous, and ensure that they're all pushing in the same direction. I think one of the main things that we've found that has grown exponentially over time is this notion of ambiguity. And there, in my belief, is when Aaron and I were just by ourselves building product, there was zero ambiguity. Like, we between each other knew what each other were thinking. I would have an understanding of how to solve a problem, and I'd give that understanding to Aaron super quickly, and he would then just develop it.
Because you were just sat next to each other, because exactly. You're talking all the time.
Exactly. Almost like osmosis, like by just being next to each other and working together really closely. You then introduce somebody else into that equation. You introduce somebody who isn't in the same room. There then become so many impediments to that communication. There's a time lapse on how long it takes you to actually ask a question on Slack. There's that interruption into your own flow by asking that person to jump on a meeting to explain something. There are all these different things that ambiguity just increases with the level of people that you bring into a business. And we scaled to around 45 people really quickly across the last few years. And in my opinion, we actually scaled way too fast. And there was a lot of lack of knowledge. There was a lack of understanding. There was a lack of this sort of core documentation, this living and breathing, I guess, lifeblood of the business, where people could refer to actually get up to speed really quickly and understand all of the different domains. Because the domain that we operate in is so complex. There's so many different pieces of tax that you need to give that autonomy to teams to be able to operate by themselves. But we didn't have that. And as we scaled, we found that. And then the whole sort of market was really tough. In the last few years, we were finding it quite hard to raise, and we then had to actually scale back the team. So then going through that ride of sort of hiring, moving really fast, really great energy around the business, to then having to let go of people has been really, really tough. And we've had obviously some amazing wins, more so of late, towards the end of last year. And we're now at the point where we feel in a really good position, where we have a lot of this source documentation. We have so much of what people need to get up to speed really quickly. And that's been one of the key parts of now growing a sustainable business, we believe, for the future.
Can we double click on that? Can we double click on what does this documentation look like practically? Mm-hmm. How is it structured? What sort of things need to get put into like official Ember documents? What things can be implicit, it's basically explicit and implicit.
Yeah, definitely.
Where's the line?
Yeah, for sure. That's something that we've actually been focusing so much time on over this past year. And I feel like we're finally getting into a good position, but it's taken like a year to get us here. So a little while ago, actually, Aaron recommended this book to me called Team Topologies. which I would recommend any startup founder to read before they think about growing their business. Because what it actually has led to is our ability to structure our teams in a way that give them autonomy, give them ownership over a certain domain, but also allow that sort of sharing of knowledge between what's known as different chapters. So the whole ethos behind Team Topologies is that you have fully autonomous stream-aligned teams. That's what they're called. And with a stream-aligned team, what you have, and this is generally an engineering concept, but it can also be applied across any other sort of domain or department or anything that you would need as a business to push forward a department. And what a streamlined team is essentially, it's you have a back-end developer, a front-end developer, a product manager, a designer, and then within that, what they have is full autonomy over a certain domain. So in our context, you could give a domain such as payroll to that team, and they will own payroll from end to end. If you have a number of teams working across a number of different domains, they essentially have to be accountants as well as engineers, as well as product managers, as well as designers. It's just an impossible task. So you need to split up those domains and give them full autonomy over what they deliver from start to finish. So that allows them then the power to actually understand and get into market really quickly the different features that they're building. One of the things that happens though with that is that there is maybe misalignment on what happens with, say, product as a department. And the way that you combat that is by actually setting up chapters. And what a chapter is essentially all the product managers from all the different teams aligning on best practices across the entire product organization. You then have an engineering chapter and you have engineers talking about the best practices that they put into place across engineering. You then have a leadership chapter. So obviously all the leadership teams sit in that chapter. You have a manager's chapter. And this is an ability for all these different teams to really then sync up and ensure that what we're doing is creating that ultimate value and pushing ourselves toward that ultimate vision.
And so then is management per stream? You have your engineer, front end, back end, you've got your designer, you've got your product manager, and then do you have a manager who manages all of them? I'm assuming not. I'm assuming the manager comes in the engineering chapter and you have your engineering manager.
Exactly. Right. Yeah, that's right. So engineering managers sit across teams and they'll sit in the engineering chapter as well as the managing chapter. And it's a really interesting way to actually make sure that then everybody's aligning on all of those different best practices. And to maybe go back to your point on the sort of documentation then that lives and breathes within our organization to help facilitate this process. We've just really recently created these and we do use Notion. Sorry for mentioning it. Everyone thinks that Notion's a bit of a... Notion is amazing.
I love Notion, mate. What are you talking about?
There's so many funny memes around like just founders who talk about Notion. It's it's quite good.
There's a reason because it's great.
Yeah, it's true. But we've created what... we've created this sort of... not copyright, but like I'd like to say Ember Notion of... our wiki. And essentially what it is, it's like everything that happens within the business sits on the Ember wiki. And we have now team spaces as well as team sheets. So think about it from the sporting analogy. A team sheet is essentially that team, all the different positions in that team. So we have the, if it's say one of our teams is called team push, P-O-O-S-H. So like, yeah, it's hilarious. It's such a bad name. But they have within this team sheet, all of the team players. We have what the purpose and vision of that team is. So a team mission statement. We have all the metrics that they own and they're trying to push towards. We have all the domains that they own. And then what happens is a new person comes into the team. They get full access to that team sheet. And what lives in that team sheet is something known as reference documentation. So we have two different types of documentation. There's reference documentation and then there's living documentation. And reference docs are things that have gone through that draft process, had all the feedback on it, and now we think it's in a good state to bring into this team sheet so that anybody can come in, read it, get up to speed with what, say, payroll is, what their sort of functioning of the team is, and how they go about, say, all their different rituals and those sorts of things. There's then the team spaces, which is actually team specific. So that will sit at the team level and they'll be able to work on, say, one-to-ones, things like living documentation that goes back and forth, documentation on the product, things that get bounced around quite frequently, and then also how they actually work together, so as a team. that's more team specific and more focused on that specific team rather than for everybody else. We found this is a really effective way to get across, I guess, the organization, what everybody does, and make sure everybody's up to speed with everything.
So you have these different like layers. Mm. You've got your spaces, which is like the bottom layer. It's working documentation. It's stuff that's constantly changing or being updated. None of it is like... I don't want to say like a finished product, but obviously yeah, everything's exactly. in draft. So something that's been drafted lots of times, or at least something hasn't been drafted lots of times in the spaces. And then one-to-one, something that basically isn't going to get shared publicly throughout the company. Mm. And then above that, you have these team sheets, which is something that's been through draft, as you exactly. said, team mission statements, vision, yep. anything that could help someone get up to speed as fast as possible yep. in order to then start contributing to that team.
Yeah, correct.
Really, really impactful. Is this all in that book, Team Topology?
No, no. So this is actually pulling from like a load of different sources. It's actually something that we've created ourselves at Ember. So Team Topologies is more so about how you actually have those stream-aligned teams and enabling teams is another concept there. For instance, like QA looks after, this is quality assurance, like on the testing front for the business, they'll sit across different teams. That engineering manager is an enabling team as well. Helping those teams actually do what they need to do by, say, taking away a lot of the admin, helping them with their one-to-ones. So Team Topology is about how you structure teams. Process and documentation is actually something that we've actually created ourselves. And this notion of sort of living documentation, reference documentation. I would actually quote Stripe there as well. So Stripe actually do this quite
you
well.
You're such a Stripe fanboy. And we're going to talk about them later as well.
Patrick and John fan, that's for sure. But they are a long-form document company, they call themselves. And what that means is that they make sure everything is documented. So everything, every decision, every process, everything that they do at Stripe has a long-form document that anybody can reference and pick up and understand really, really quickly. But what that creates then is this, like, I guess, bank of knowledge that can become outdated as well. So there needs to be processes in place like ours in that we have a wiki, and there's actually a verified like tick on that wiki that says this was verified last month or the month before. And there are things that actually have automated reviews that go out. So you have to review, say, our vision and mission every year. And that sends us a prompt. We review that or every 6 months or however long the sort of cadence is to make sure that that doesn't go stale and there's people reading sort of old documentation there as well.
What else gets reviewed? And in what cadence?
Pretty much all of the reference documentation gets reviewed quite frequently because, as we said before, that is at that sort of final state. So after draft, it's gone in, but it, again, can become quite stale quite quickly because things just happen and move so rapidly across the business. Mm-hmm. And then all of the living documentation is just living. It's generally referred back to quite often and frequently.
That's incredible. Do you have like, I'm just riffing here, it sounds like you have like really clear processes for this communication from a document perspective. Would you still have that if you were fully in person? Like it sounds like a really healthy practice. It sounds like it's been pushed along by the fact that everyone's remote and you have to find a solution because you're not sitting next to each other.
Yeah, definitely.
Do you think you'd still be here if you hadn't have gone remote?
Yeah, that's a great question actually as well. And I think maybe to move into why we actually became remote first and foremost was actually remember going out and hiring just off the back of COVID. We were still forcing people to come into the office. So we were saying we were trying to look around London. We were even looking on sort of the outskirts of London as well. And I remember two consecutive amazing candidates we missed out on because we were going to say you have to come into the office at least 3 days a week. And Aaron and I both kind of sat down and we were like, shit, we're losing out on some really good candidates here by not being as flexible or remote first. So what should we do? Because both of us really believed in that power of in-person connection and having people sit in the one room together. We really had to adapt off the back of that and say that, well, if we want to continue and we want to try and hire people across the UK who have got the best experience for these roles, then maybe we do have to become a little bit more open. And that's when we said, We actually then made this hire, a guy by the name of Serge, who lives in Portugal, and he has literally single-handedly brought this engineering organization to where it is today, like in a lot of its sort of like development practices and processes, and he just could ship products so quickly. And we hired him, and he was just an incredible hire. And so we had this really great experience with somebody living in Portugal, being able to just hammer out code, and like we wouldn't be in the position we are without him now, had we not had him. And so we really learned from that, and we adapted off the back and said, okay, well, we would just really need to hire people where they do their best work. And that has become the philosophy of Ember. So you should do your work where you do your best work. For Aaron and I, that's in the office. For the majority of the company, that's at home or where they live. So we've really become a product of that now. And I think that just then has really reinforced how important it is to have all of this documentation and living, I guess, reference things that people can understand and get up to speed really quickly on. Mm-hmm. So it's all about aligning people. I mean, at the end of the day, Aaron and I's main job is to make sure that everybody's aligned around a common purpose and a single vision that everybody is moving towards. If you don't have this lifeblood of the company sort of rolling through, then you just have people moving in all different directions. And what we needed to do was actually bring all of that together. And that's why we created this sort of wiki page as well.
It reminds me of Elon talking about people as vectors. Vector implies that something has speed and direction.
Mm.
And so people always talk about like ship fast, which is only talking about speed.
Yeah.
But actually, if you have two people shipping fast in the opposite directions, then we don't go anywhere. If they're shipping at the same speed, right? And very so then, as per what you've just said, if as long as you align people predominantly, then you move a lot faster and a lot further. So moving on from communication, it sounds like you have a really exciting and effective process around that. We've now got this problem of disconnection. You've got you and Aaron love being in the office. You've become best mates through the process of working side by side, and those relationships ideally we want to try and build between lots of team members, but everyone's remote, everyone's working at home.
Yeah.
And so that leads us to a bigger focus on other ways of connecting the team.
Yeah.
So how do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I've learned a lot from you here in my time. And one of the things we now do, and this was a lot probably driven off what I've learned from people across the founders community actually, is that because we are fully remote, we make sure that we have quarterly offsites. So every quarter we get everybody together, and that's actually happening next week, as I mentioned earlier, up at West Lexham, again, where we met. And what we do is actually take the entire company away for 3 days. And within that 3 days, we really give them that opportunity to compassionately connect with each other. And I know that's TM, AJ. but during that time, what happens is people create this connection that you can't create virtually. And once you've created that connection, you then feel so much more comfortable, say, reaching out to someone and just actually asking them how their day was, rather than like talking about a sprint or talking about a deliverable. Actually catching up with them about, say, what they did on the weekend, because a lot of these things that are facilitated via Slack and via virtual means can seem a little bit disingenuous and they seem a little bit forced. There's this one thing that a lot of people actually use called donut.
Donut.
Yeah. And I just don't love it. Like I feel like it's a little bit sort of created. It's a little bit sort of fake, I think. And making sure that people actually can be in person and peel back a few layers. And that's what we really try and do on these offsites. So the schedule for next week is about, so that the theme for the week is actually entering into uncharted territory. So we are about to have a big launch within the company with one of the biggest banks in the world of our new embedded product. So the last few years, what it's taught us is that we could acquire customers direct to customer, but we needed a new way in which we could actually go to market. And embedded is our future. So we're actually embedding into a whole load of different banks, and we can talk about that. But what we want this sort of next phase of the business to really be about is entering into this uncharted territory, because we are forging a new path. We're going where no one has ever gone before with this particular solution that we've built. And so what we want to do is actually empower everybody that works with us to actually tell us their stories about how they've been into uncharted territory before and really create that understanding. Okay, well, I mean, I played Aussie Rules, for instance, back in Australia, and how I entered into sort of uncharted territory with that, in that like I was so scared that like I didn't know whether I was good enough, I was never going to sort of make it. But perseverance with that then meant that I could also understand the actual value of, say, getting an education and moving into sort of university, and pegging those two things off against each other has now allowed me to move into this entrepreneur role where, I mean, entrepreneurship is all just uncharted territory. It's like, I think the essence of running a business is not knowing what's going to happen next. So really what we're trying to do is power people to tell us their stories and get that common understanding between each other, so that they can then, following the offsite, reconnect and keep that sort of dramatic arc going. And the dramatic arc is something that you have told me. I don't know if you've talked about it on a previous podcast, but I think it's genius and it's hilarious. Like Aaron and I sit in the office like talking about the dramatic arc, and no one like at home probably knows anything about what we're talking about. And I guess you can maybe explain it a little bit better than I can, but to maybe take you verbatim. The dramatic arc is all about sort of creating that pre-anticipation for something that you're going to go on. So something like an offsite, really building up. And the way that we've been building up is actually by doing this theme and getting everybody alongside. And we've created this map. So in Notion, it's the offsite map to help you actually navigate uncharted territory. And it goes through like getting everybody ready about thinking about where they have historically been in uncharted territory, going through the whole schedule for the offsite, getting people prepared. So the dramatic arc is actually as you're coming up on this curve. And then that peak moment within the offsite has to be when people are compassionately connecting at their peak. And for us, we have a session actually that is similar to tribes, where people will go off and talk to each other about what's happening in their lives, about what's happening aside from business, because that can be a really important thing that goes into understanding why, say, they're not performing at work. And that is the peak moment of our offsite. And then as you come off the offsite, then want to make sure that there is a continuation of that feeling and bringing people along, because there is that sort of afterglow effect. And then that's why we have them quarterly, because then you start going back into the peak again and going back up and getting everybody back excited. And obviously it's that sort of peak and trough that happens throughout the year, but you really feel it at the end of, say, the quarter, when you're just about to catch up. People are maybe feeling a bit disconnected, people are kind of going off in different directions, and you bring them all back together at this offsite, and it really creates that ability to just all move in the same direction. So that's one of the ways. So it's quite a long-winded way of explaining how we make sure that those in-person connections are still there. But the other thing is that, I mean, the other reality is that we do live in a virtual world, and we have to make sure that people are catching up virtually, not just for work. And what we've actually done recently is implemented a weekly all hands. is a weekly all hands. And we have a half an hour presentation from each of the different teams. So we have four teams across the business, four streamlined teams. And each of those teams take rotating responsibility for all hands every week. And the fifth slot goes to Aaron and I as the business. And following that half an hour, we then have a full half an hour of a virtual activity where everybody jumps on. And there's a prize at the end of the year for the best virtual activity run. Ooh. So everyone's incentivized to make it as good as possible.
What's the prize?
And they've been amazing. It's actually a bonus.
Amazing. And so each week someone new comes up with the virtual activity.
Exactly. Yeah. So then you've got like an injection of new sort of ideas and thoughts into what a cool virtual event can be, rather than just it being run by us or the people department, which is Aaron and I.
HR.
Yeah.
That was a great explanation of the dramatic arc template. It's really good.
Yeah, anything to add, sorry, from the master?
Definitely not the master. I learned this. This is not mine. I learned this from a experience design course called Scaling Intimacy. And the idea, very fancy, the idea is around taking somebody through a transformative experience. And so you imagine a sort of lopsided triangle where you have like a slow build up to this peak and then a slightly sharper line back down to your x-axis. And the peak is, let's say, if the intention of the experience is to deeply connect people, then it'll be, let's say, a peak could be someone sharing very vulnerably and everyone else holding like a very safe and trusting space for that person. And then they feel a lot more connected because of that experience. And I love that you're thinking really intentionally about this build up and like work before the actual experience, because that's what most people miss. Most people think the experience start when it's like Friday at lunchtime and you're all getting on the bus to go to this place.
Yeah,
and actually, as you've said, the experience starts as soon as you tell somebody that this is happening.
Exactly.
And that prep, the better you do that pre-in-person experience work, then the more impactful the peak experience can be. So I think it's amazing that you've set this map for uncharted territory. And also it's like, people generally don't talk about their personal lives with work colleagues. So that in and of itself is uncharted territory.
I was just about to say, that's a really interesting point that you just brought up there, because I guess being vulnerable with your coworkers is quite different to being vulnerable with other founders, which obviously we do get into when we go on a founder's retreat. And I think that is quite an interesting one, because we've had a bit of pushback actually internally from some people saying that I just want to keep my work life, my personal life. Why are you kind of making me blur the lines a little bit here? And in that respect, you do have to kind of respect people's thought processes when it comes to how they treat work. And it has been a bit of a tricky water to navigate actually with some people. And I think a lot of them have actually said, like, why do we do these quarterly offsites? There's been a bit of pushback on that sort of in-person connection, because they just love working from home and they don't want that kind of involvement with these other like people. They just want to try and do their job, like get the job done. And I guess like it's really interesting, because you then have all of these conflicting ideas, but you need to sort of play in the middle ground a little bit and make sure that people do feel included and they're not pushed too far to their boundaries. So you do put a little bit of a guardrail on, whereas I think in the founders context and getting people together and being super vulnerable with each other, because there is no other kind of link when it comes to say work. We don't sort of go that far and we kind of bring it a little bit sort of closer to the middle.
How did you navigate that conversation with people who aren't as open to it?
So I think like from my perspective, it's all been about like, I guess, explaining the benefits of why it is so important to compassionately connect with your employees and with your coworkers. Because what comes off the back of it is just so much better productivity, such a better life at work. Like, why would you want to say have something really deep and like shit going on in your personal life and just be a different person at work and like think like everything's cool and sweet? Where we can actually help you with those problems that are happening in your life. And we can, I mean, yeah, we've had countless stories of hardships of sort of people within Ember. As one dev, who obviously won't name, but she just seems to have like the worst luck. She was one of the people that actually got caught up in the tornado in Manchester. Her roof came off her house. It's just like, what? This woman just has like such bad luck, and she's just an amazing developer, and like we've helped her through, I think, a lot of those really tough times. And that has, to her, just made her life exponentially better rather than just walling it off, and has in turn made her a much better developer, because she's been so open to learning from other people and actually feeling as though like her personal life isn't holding her back in her role. And I think if you just break down those walls between those two, it allows you just to be yourself. And I think that is one of our values is obviously, but one of our values at Ember is to bring your whole self to work, no matter who that whole self is. And we really do try and live by that. And this element of tribes at the offsite is a way to to sort of live by that value.
Yeah, I mean, I feel very strongly about this point. Shock. I obviously do see why people don't want to sometimes, well, they want to have this separation.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, we're all like deeply emotional and irrational people that, like,
We work with accountants.
Sorry, most people are deeply emotional.
We hire accountants.
And if you're having a horrible time at home, then it's almost impossible to not bring it into work in some way, shape or form. Mm. Like, and vice versa. Like, yeah. When have you like had a really tough time at work and then you just flip a switch when you get home to your partner or anyone else that you're with and you're like suddenly super happy and engaged? Like, it just doesn't happen. Yeah. It all bleeds into one another. Yeah. And I think the more we let it flow naturally, then just the more aligned, fulfilled, happier in life that will be, I think it's actually like,
it's really important actually, like, foray maybe into like this notion of where your boundaries are though, which is quite interesting, because I do agree with you to an extent, because there are some things that, say, Aaron and I have to make sure that we shield like people from, but make sure that like we are bringing them along to also help us deal with those uncertainties. So I think it's a really tricky one that founders have to navigate and business owners have to navigate in general, around how much information is too much information.
Mm. And so we're zooming out from the sort of individual perspective now.
Yes, exactly.
Where people are questioning like, oh, I don't want to share this much information with my colleagues. Mm. And we're now looking at the wider business to be like, as a founder, how much information is too much information, and where are the boundaries of that?
That, as well as from a personal element, I think, because I guess like how much emotion Aaron and I show in certain situations really impacts how other people feel about their day to day. For instance, case in point, when we're fundraising, you saw what I went through. You saw how shit it was, like constant rejection, constant sort of feedback on how we can improve, like what about what we're doing wrong, why it's too early for us to invest, like all this stuff that you're dealing with. And then you have to put on that stronger front to the business so that they don't feel like, shit, we're going to run out of money in a couple of weeks and we're off because we need to find another job. It's a really like interesting line, because although I definitely want to try and be as open as I can with people and bring them along and ensure that they're there to actually empower us as leaders rather than us mollycoddling them through business. But there are some things that you do need to be strong about, and you do need to obviously keep the faith and keep pushing forward, especially within this sort of fundraising environment at the moment that is just super tricky. One that you do to an element or to an extent need to sort of shield employees from.
Do you have a framework? Let's say we remove fundraising to the side and instead you're at this offsite next week. Mm. How are you drawing a line between sharing information versus not, as the leader, as the people, as the person that all of your employees are looking up to and they get confidence from? Like, if we step out of the nightmare often, or the chaos that is fundraising a lot of the time, and do you have boundaries elsewhere? Like, how do you think about it?
It's a really tricky question, because I think like when you ask someone about their boundaries, it's not like I've written everything down.
Yeah. It's not like, I thought you guys have these documentation.
I've got this set of boundaries that like, oh no, not gonna go there.
It's just not in your team sheet where you have Dan boundaries.
but I don't believe that I have a framework. I think in these situations, intuition is a really important thing. And I think that's probably one of my powers, is knowing maybe where that line is. And I think some people don't necessarily have that intuition, or they can go one way or the other. They can kind of not share enough, or share too much. And I feel the power is actually where you can ensure that somebody feels as though they understand you, but always reserve just a little bit for that much closer, deeper conversation or personal relationship that you have with someone, say as I have with you, because those relationships are quite different to, say, an employee relationship. So I think there is still definitely a line. And on that continuum of where that line is, I think there's like where you and I are obviously quite far to the right, and then probably where my employees are a bit further towards the middle. But knowing where that line is on all of the different topics, when they come up and when it all happens so quickly, is where some people can sometimes misstep and say something that they regret, either in public or to an employee, that they wish they hadn't have said. So I think knowing where that line is for you is quite opaque and not necessarily defined, but should be something that is intuitively felt, I think.
Mm. Yeah, and I mean, I've got this wrong recently. And I think it feels like you have different boundaries for different situations.
Mm.
So in this team offsite that you're going to, let's say,
mm.
you have tribes, and that's mm. a group of sort of 6 to 8 people usually. Yeah. And it's often quite open sharing. Mm. However, somebody may not share as openly as if it was just one-on-one.
Mm.
And so I think size of the group or how many people also has an impact. And then the case of like, if you record something and it goes out in content, like you actually don't even know how many people it's going to go to or who will see it. So then there's a different set of boundaries there.
Yeah.
So that's really interesting. But I think the intuitive part makes a lot of sense. And I suppose the issue is that a lot of time at work, we don't tap into that intuitive side very often. Mm. It's often like neck up thinking.
Yeah, true.
It's like, it's all cognitive and conscious thinking as opposed to subconscious feeling. Which is also another separation, which is interesting to go into. But
I think it's also like about knowing, and I heard a really great quote actually recently about how you talk, and it was, do you think to talk or talk to think? And that for me was so powerful, because like, I know that I like am somebody who just talks to think. Like, I have no idea what's going to come out before it comes out. But when it comes out, I then think of something really, say, interesting or epic to say, whereas Aaron is a complete opposite to that. Like, he will ruminate on something, make sure that he has it buttoned up super tight before he talks.
And then he reads off the slide.
And then he reads off the slide. Exactly. And I think actually identifying that with each other is something that's super important as well. And with the people, say, that you work with or that your direct reports. And one of the really important things is that I, with everybody who I manage, I have a sheet on myself as to like how I like to work and how I best get the best out of you and how I will coach you and how I will help you through, say, all of the different things that you need and the best ways of communication. It's almost like a cheat sheet on me. And that is the first thing I say, is that I generally talk to think. So if you're going to send me this huge, like just barrage of like conversation that has to do with a certain topic, I'm probably not going to like get into the details and read it all and then be able to really easily respond to you. So let's just maybe jump on a call and get through that in like, say, 10 minutes or like 5 minutes, like versus this back and forth, like written communication, which can sometimes be just a bit much for me. Whereas Aaron's the complete opposite. Like, he'll just send barrages of like information, and I'd send like a one paragraph response sort of thing, and
a voice note.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's it. It's a really interesting sort of dynamic to maybe call out in yourself and understand in yourself what you are or how you actually think, so that other people can actually work with you in the way that you work best as well.
Mm. Did you get this from Costa?
The talk to think to talk. Definitely got it from someone. I actually think it was our old head of people that we got it from, Rika. She was amazing, but unfortunately we had to let her go.
I'd love to talk about that now as well. Like, we were living together when you were fundraising, and also when Runway was getting lower and lower, and most founders, I don't know any founder really that hasn't had to go through the extremely tough time, probably like the nightmare that is firing people. How do you approach firing?
Yeah, it's fucking tricky. It is probably one of the worst parts of the job, I'd say. I actually remember the first time I had to do it, and it's maybe a little bit embarrassing, but I actually cried. I remember just an amazing guy, like amazing operator, had brought so much to the business, and we were going through the process of trying to fundraise. We got knocked back and we were so close at so many different times. And it got to the point where we had to start making some decisions to try and extend our runway to make sure that we could raise and get to the next stage. And I had a conversation with him, and at the start he was just so open himself, and he actually ended up, the conversation went like, he was like, mate, it's going to be okay.
Just consoling you.
It's like, what just happened? Dude, like, I just let you go. But I think showing that you actually care, like as in showing him that like it hurt me to essentially have to let him go, and really respected how much he had done for us and how much he'd helped us and got us to where we are today, and giving them the context that if we don't make this decision now, as bad as it sounds, unfortunately, if it's not you, it'll be everybody. And they, at the end of the day, do understand. I think in most situations, a lot of other situations we've had to let people go who have just had a baby, who have got some really deep stuff going on in their own personal lives, and they just suck. Like the conversations just suck. But as I said, I think the most important thing that you can do is just show them that you genuinely care. And even being in the startup position that we're in, it's not like you can even give them a good package. It's like we're on our like not last legs, but like we're getting towards like running on a runway. We're not even going to be able to give you like a great package. But like just we need like to say thank you for everything that you've done to us, for us, and ensure that they actually feel valued. And then off the back of that, there are things that you can do. So one of the most important things that you do is post on your founders network or post on your LinkedIn or give them the recommendation, go through how they can try and find another job, talk to contacts. The number of people that we've let go who I've gotten jobs for, I remember Cam got him a job through a connection that I had actually when I used to work at Deloitte. There are just so many things that you can do for them off the back of the sort of redundancy, rather than just say a package or other things that we did for them. Actually, were allowed them to maintain access to our mental health platform. So for our employees, we use Oliva Health, which is an ability for everyone to book in therapy sessions. And if we have let you go, you get access to it for like the next year. Like you can still like continue using Oliva Health. You can go through that therapy of trying to help you deal with this blow and moving on to the next thing. We also allow them to hold on to their laptop for the next 3 months, because that is the most important time they need it for job searching. And some people can't actually sort of have access to a machine or anything like that. So all of those things that come off the back are really important to show that, again, you care, and that they can essentially deal with this next phase of their life in the way that they need to and maintain those relationships going forward. It's hilarious. We always joke, Aaron and I are always in the office, and we still have 3 or 4 people who used to work for us come into the office. Like they're the only people that actually come in, not current Ember employees. It's bizarre. One of our first hire, actually Drew, who holds a special place in all of our hearts, comes in pretty much most weeks into the office, even though he works for the Modern House now.
So they still have their WeWork pass?
No, so we just let them in as guests. Yeah.
Gotcha. That sounds like amazing after firing care.
Mm.
And that is such a beautiful standard that you've set that I think so many people can take inspiration from. How do you manage the like pre-firing period? You've had the conversation with Aaron, you're like, runway's running out and we need to extend the runway. We have to let go of some people.
Mm.
These are the people that make the most sense that we need to for the sake of the business.
Yeah.
Once you've made that decision, before you've had the conversation with them, is there anything that you do in that period?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one, actually. And I think the process here is actually quite different depending on how many people you're letting go. So there are actually some like rules and regulations that you have to make sure that you abide by. So for instance, if you're letting go more than 20 people at one period of time, you have to go into what's known as a consultation period. So there are some practical things around that you actually have to make sure that you do. That is actually by, say, putting a role into redundancy rather than the person. This is for much bigger companies. So for us, we were at the stage where we obviously had 45. So there were only probably a couple of people, say, with the same role title. So the thing with redundancies is if you put a role into redundancy, you can't then hire for that role again for the next, say, 3-6 months because you've made that role redundant. So for instance, the head of partnerships, there's only one head of partnerships. So we made that role redundant. Obviously, it's the person who is the head of partnerships who's going to go for that. But say there were three head of partnerships, you'd have to put the role into redundancy and you'd have to do a consultation period with all three to work out who has the best skill set to essentially move forward with the role and who will then miss out and who will get made redundant. So that process, and then you can offer voluntary redundancies as well for people who want to actually take the package and move on. And so a lot of those things can feed into that sort of pre-redundancy period and decision-making. And I think, again, it's all about being fair and understanding for the business structure at this point in time, what are the best roles that will push us forward? And that was where we actually then made the conscious decision to make sure that we were much more weighted towards senior roles within the business. So we put a lot of the junior roles at redundancy. And as harsh as that sounds, it was because we just didn't have the ability to give them what they needed from a training perspective and get them to that point where they could start moving up into sort of middle and then more senior resource. And I think we made the mistake actually over the last like few years of going too heavily junior and not hiring enough sort of senior earlier on. I would actually recommend, I would always say go more senior much earlier on than hiring too junior and falling into the trap of not having the ability to give them what they need when it comes to a training perspective.
Mm. When's earlier on?
So I reckon like even the stage that we're at now as a 28 person business, we still have been hiring quite senior. And interestingly enough, like another Stripe reference here, but Stripe were 30 people for about 5 years, which I never knew. And Aaron actually told me the other day, they're obviously now like multiple thousands and they scaled super quickly. But for 5 years, John and Patrick, like, didn't fumble, but like we're trying to find what it was that was going to be that inflection point. And I think we're actually at our 5 year mark now. And we're 28 people. So a lot of similarities. But yeah, I mean, that kind of goes back to what I was saying before of I do firmly believe that running a startup is running it and surviving until you find that moment where there is that inflection point. So being battered for the last sort of 5 years, going at all different routes into market, going at different sort of pivots and ways in which we can actually get into customers' hands and solve the ultimate vision. You always need to have what it is you're trying to achieve, and that can't change, obviously. But the way that you get there changes so much along the way. And I've definitely found that. And surviving those knocks are essentially what will allow you to get to the point to then hit that inflection point and land on the thing that will take you to the next level. And we do really feel like that is our next journey into this sort of uncharted territory for that around this embedded piece.
So what helps you maintain this resilience, which is ultimately what you need to get hit down seven times and get up eight?
So resilience actually to me is the way that I was brought up. So as a founder, I have probably more resilience than other people, I believe, because I actually lost my mom when I was quite young. And she passed away from lymphoma Hodgkin's disease when I was about 8 years old. And I always tell myself that the worst things that happen in business aren't as bad as losing your parent when you're 8 years old. And I think that's the like leveling for me. That's every time I'm going through a shit situation, and experiencing something really bad within the business, I just think, well, I'm still alive and I'm not going to have to go through what I did with my mom and it'll be fine. And I think having that perspective for me has been what has allowed me to be super resilient in these different situations, because I put it into perspective and understand what life is about, and having life is obviously the most important part. Yeah.
Interestingly, I was chatting to Sam Knight not too long ago about this exact topic, and he had exactly the same framing, which was like, any problem you have, it's not as bad as losing your parent. It's not as bad as this like really intense traumatic experience.
Yeah.
And he then said that that limited him in terms of how he empathized with his team.
Yeah, interesting.
And because he would almost project it onto his team, saying, well, like, you have a problem like firing someone, it's not that bad, like no one's dying, right?
Yeah, interesting.
But actually it's still challenging for them.
Yeah.
And so maybe can reframe the question, which is, how do we help others build resilience in the team? Because everyone has to be resilient with constantly changing directions and constantly getting hit and knocked down 7 times to get up 8 as a collective. So how do you as the leader instill that in others, or do you have any approach to that?
Yeah, definitely. It's actually one of our core values. And I think the main thing that comes with this part of resilience is not being afraid to fail. And we have it. That is one of our like sort of core values, is that like, we won't chastise you for failing. It's like if you fail again on the same thing, you need to learn from those mistakes essentially. So I think one of the most the interesting ways to answer this question is all around empowering someone to actually first experience what it is to have failed or done something wrong, to then know that they should learn from their mistakes. And if you don't fail, then you're not doing your job properly, or you're not doing the right thing. Because if you're never getting that kind of real-time feedback of what like you could improve next time, people either aren't being honest with you, or you're kind of living in this little bubble. And so that's one of the key things that we always make sure that people are never afraid to fail. And we're experiencing this firsthand in the difference in culture of actually working with a massive banking organization and us. But I think working with large corporates is where this incessant like fear of failure has just taken hold, and it created so much inefficiency because everyone's passing the buck. Because if you fail, you won't get promoted. And if you fail, like you've put the company in this really bad position. And what that has bred is just this massive inefficiency of people getting in the room together. And even though, say, something is red or on fire, it's like, nah, it's green, it's all good. Like, we're all sweet. Like when you go through like the red, amber, greens or whatever of your workflow, you're never like, you're always too scared almost to say that something's wrong and try and get some help on it and build that resilience as you fail. Because again, you just don't build it if you don't fail, and you will just continue to just live in this kind of bubble world of not understanding what it is to actually fail.
But then what I've just connected is that as a CEO, you still have to have, or as COO, as someone who's leading the business, right? You still have to have this confidence and assuredness and instill that with everyone else that like everything's good, like you're fundraising, right?
Yeah.
So there's a balance between like, you want to share about your failures, right? At the same time, you can't share too many failures because you don't want everyone's confidence to get knocked and then start stressing.
Yeah, exactly.
But then it's also one of the values. Yeah. And I'm a big believer in leading by example. And I feel like you are too. Mm. That is such a difficult thing to balance.
As long as you can always explain how you've learned from those failures and make that as public as possible, I don't actually see as much sort of detriment to saying that you've failed in a certain, to a certain extent. You always have to have the next plan, if you know what I mean. So it's like, we failed on direct customer distribution. We had too high payback periods. We spent way too much money on advertising. We weren't acquiring efficiently. So we needed a way to acquire efficiently. We learned from that mistake, and we now pivoted the entire business to moving into this embedded world. So we had that follow-up plan of saying, okay, well, we've learned from this. We know what the next actionable outcome is, and we're going to lead by example by telling you about our failures, like being super honest about it, but saying that we've learned from that, and we're now moving on to this next phase of the business to acquire customers efficiently and make sure that we've actually patched that problem that we had historically.
It's like, don't just come with a problem, come with the problem, the learning, and then a potential next step.
Exactly. That's it. 100%.
We've been dancing around it a little bit, but I'd love to talk about your fundraise journey.
Yep.
Also a tricky one.
Yeah.
How many conversations did you have in the end before closing the round?
Yeah, so end of last year, probably got to around, I reckon it was maybe 95 different like VCs I spoke to. That's not including angels.
Damn. 95 conversations, not including angels, but you got it over the line. How much did you raise? From who? And would love to hear about that process. And I mean, talk about resilience, like Jesus.
Yeah. You saw me at my worst, that's for sure.
You look great at your worst.
Thanks,
just to caveat that, your worst is fabulous.
So we actually ended up raising $4 million, which is awesome.
Was that seed two?
That was seed two. A seed extension. It's all just a big branding exercise. Yeah. So at the end of last year, we were lucky enough to meet a guy by the name of Phil, who runs a VC fund that he's just created called Shapers. Phil is the most epic person, the most connected person I think I've ever met in my life. He just knows everyone, and he, throughout the entire sort of fundraising journey, was evaluating us as a potential investment, but also just connecting us to a ton of people. And he spent probably 3 months before actually making the investment decision to invest in us, going through his DD process. And that was by talking to Ember employees, talking to almost a former employee of mine, going really deep on the founders, going deep with all of the potential partners that we had lined up, with HSBC and the launch of the embedded product. He went really deep on that side, and he was able to actually introduce us to a fund called Valar, who were actually the initial investors in Xero. And they exited that when they went public, and now they're looking for the Xero killer. So super cool fund. They have also had some amazing investments in N26, in Wise, very early on.
Wow.
Massive operation. The COO of Valar is actually the founder of Valar is actually the old COO of Peter Thiel's family office, a guy by the name of James Fitzgerald, and super cool dude, looks like a Viking. Very, very cool. And he got in a conversation with me after months and months of going through all of these really long drawn out DD processes, getting to final investment committees with VCs, and having the vote go 3-2 in rejection of Ember. And we experienced so many of those situations where we were at the final hurdle, like just about to get the term sheet, and they went to investment committee, and there was too much uncertainty around the future of embedded, and we hadn't launched with HSBC yet. So there was this whole apprehension around, well, if it doesn't go well, what then happens? What's the next phase? And just because of the market and because of where the entire venture capital market has moved in all of this uncertainty, they were just betting on certain things, and they were just keeping all of this dry powder and not actually investing in, say, the vision anymore, or the idea, or the new route to market. They wanted full on product market fit, and they were just investing in businesses that had that. So it was a tough journey. And coming back to sort of Valar and the conversation I had with James, we literally got on for like 45 minute conversation. And I think after that 45 minute conversation, he had made the decision to invest. He was just, he had that much conviction, that much belief in us as founders. The story by that stage, obviously after the 90 odd rounds of feedback, was pretty on point. And literally we then had a catch up with Aaron for probably 15, like 20 minutes. Off the back of that, he was like, yep, guys, I'm super keen to give you a term sheet. Let's do this. And ever since, Phil's now on our board and has been adding so much value. We also have Sophie Winwood on our board, actually, who's an Anthemist, ex-Anthemist now, I should say. She's now at Fox Capital. A little plug for Fox Capital and Ruth. she actually runs a community called WVC, which is a community for women in venture capital, which is really cool as well. We are essentially now closed the round. We've got some amazing angels on board as well. Phil has been able to introduce us to some seriously incredible people. We're now in this amazing position where we've got this embedded product that's really going to help us scale up our go-to-market and essentially take us to that next level. So yeah, on that path from 30 to thousands.
Watch out the, what is it? John
and Patrick.
John and Patrick, yeah, coincidence. That'd be funny. Do you remember the story that I told you about meeting John Collinson?
No. Oh, you did actually. That's right. Yeah, that would be a great story.
I met John Collinson at Sifted after he was the headline speaker at the end. Matt Clifford, who founded EF, interviewed him. And I have this switch in me where if I see an opportunity and it feels really uncomfortable, I have to take it. And I was like, okay, how many opportunities do you get with meeting someone like John Collinson and Matt Clifford, both of them? And so they had this incredible talk and then they came off stage and I was one of the dozen or so people that rushed backstage or like to the edge of the stage to try and chat with them. And I was thinking while I was listening to them speak, like, how could I possibly add value to these people? Like, realistically, Stripe is multiple billions.
That's okay, Joe.
And I first got up to Matt Clifford because someone else was talking to John. And everyone was like queuing up, like in a very neat, polite English way, and queuing up to talk to John. And so I just went behind them and talked to Matt straight away. And I was like, oh, hey, Matt, like, I obviously know a lot about EF and doing community stuff. Like, let me know if I can help with anything community based with EF. And he was like, yeah, I've kind of like not doing as much with EF now, but send me an email and for sure we can chat. I was like, cool, amazing. Lovely to meet you. And then I turn around and I'm like behind John and I'm like looking at John's there and then everyone else is like lined up to chat to him. And someone tries to like stop everyone from coming and chatting to them. And so then I'm in between John and Matt. And then I say, oh, hey, John, how's it going? I'm AJ. I'm a super connector. And so is there anyone in the world that you would like to be connected with? And I'll make it happen. And he goes, oh God, AJ, like that's a lot of pressure. I said, well, John, like, it's just an opportunity. Like what's the worst that could happen? And he stops and he thinks for a minute and he goes, I think I'm pretty well connected. I'm like, that's fair enough. I was like, lovely to meet you, John. Hopefully paths will cross soon. Let's see you later. But anyway, speaking of fundraising and going from 30 to 1,000, one question I had, which is based on how you approach fundraising, is I heard from another very successful founder that they always fundraise based off the potential of a new product, which just sounds like what you did.
Yeah.
And I think a good caveat is that they had a period of time that was a lot more flush with venture capital cash and people were investing more freely than they are now. Like, the market has shifted massively in the past couple of years. And this is the same approach that you took, but it took so much longer and it was so much more difficult to get it over the line.
Definitely.
And so now it seems like VCs, as you say, are looking for companies that have found product market fit, especially at the stage. So that must have been really tough.
Yeah, well, it's 100%. And yeah, definitely echoing that sentiment. I think there's been this huge correction in the market. Like, as you said, peak of 2021, there were these crazy valuations rolling around for people who had created a slide and are already raising it like 100 mil plus, like of valuation on an idea. And I think this overcorrection has happened, maybe not overcorrection, but correction has happened. And rightly so, potentially. I think a lot of money was invested into hype and there have been a lot of failures throughout that hype. And now there's this huge knock-on impact of VCs being a bit scarred by that period. And now making sure that all of their, say, investment committees are going through with almost unanimous votes of businesses rather than just the, say, 50-60 or 40-60 split sort of thing. And we are now in this position as founders where you really do have to be quite careful on cash flow and you do have to be really careful about how you approach a fundraise and ensure that, although, Costa actually told me this, that the process of going through a fundraise has to be really intentional and you say knock out all of your initial outreach in 1 week and you just line up all the first conversations at the same time, line up all the second conversations at the same time. Then you get to a point where you've got all of these people on the line with, say, a couple really warm and then you can pit them off against each other and create that competitive tension. But I think now the process is just dragging out a lot more because there are sort of VCs now just not making decisions and not pulling the trigger on things that they would have historically pulled the trigger on. And it's also had a bit of a knock-on impact on valuations. I know we've talked about them the entire time. We love Stripe.
Tell us about Stripe.
But back in 2021, they were valued at $95 billion and they are now valued. They've just had an up round. Actually, last year they were less, but now they're valued at about $60 billion. And that wipeout of like a huge amount of market cap within that valuation is just insane to think in sort of a 2-3 year period. And it's hard to understand why that happened or what was the hype in 2021 that meant they were valued at $95 billion US and now they're valued at $60 billion. And if they were to say market, if they were to say list on the public market, if they were to IPO, it'd probably be worth like another like maybe third of that, maybe $40 billion, or it's just insane to think. And now that means that companies are staying private for much longer and looking at sourcing within the venture capital world, which means that that overcorrection is now just wiping out their on paper wins. Because if you invested in Stripe back in 2021 at $95 billion, your investment's now worth a third of that if they go to sort of IPO. And it's just, going to create this huge sort of effect on all of us as founders, because what we're now seeing is that all of these valuations are trickling down into the deals that are happening at our level. And we are now seeing sort of more talk around, okay, what's your revenue multiples rather than just what's your valuation based on an idea. And that correction has happened right at the time when we all need the capital the most. So that feeds into that contingency planning that I sort of touched on, and making sure that as you do go into that funding process, you've got all the different plans to say, if we need to cut to profitability, we cut to profitability. If we need to let more people go, we let more people go. What is the sort of fallback? Because as I said, you just have to stay alive and get through that process so that you can then reload and revamp and then go again at the next pivot or the next sort of go-to-market strategy that you look.
There's a great Paul Graham article, Default Alive versus Default Dead, right?
Exactly.
I think at the turn of it all, that article is circulating within the founder community a lot, which is definitely worth a read. This has been like so deeply informative. Like, I have learned so much in this conversation. I feel so much more prepared to going into founding the next company, whatever that may be. So now, as we close, is there a sort of seminal piece of wisdom, maybe specifically around the people side of running the business, whether that's relationship with investors, relationship with Aaron, your co-founder, relationship with employees, relationship with these B2B customers like HSBC. Yeah. Been, which has also been a long journey we didn't even get to touch on.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Is there something that, let's say, a founder who is just forming their business or is pre-seed or is seed one at a stage before you, what comes to mind?
I think like what I would say there is that the path to success is not linear. Wherever you are trying to get to, what is the most important part of where you're trying to get to is that end destination. The way that you get there can be completely zigzagged, can be completely up and down, can be completely all over the place. As long as you still have that same goal and vision and mission in mind as what you want to achieve, the way in which you get there can be completely all over the place. And that will happen. Just be really cognizant of that, that no matter what happens with your startup, you're not just going to launch and it's just going to go up and to the right. Like it's just not going to happen. So really be prepared for that journey along the way and make sure that, as we've touched on in this conversation, that you do have that resilience at the core of what you're trying to achieve. And as long as you know in your mind that you're still doing it for the right reasons and you're still doing it to try and achieve that end goal and mission, then your path to that, no matter where it takes you, is the right thing.
Wow. Thank you so much, mate. It's been exceptional.
Thank you so much really for having me on. It's been awesome, AJ. And yeah, I obviously hold a lot of love for you. And I really, really hope that everything that you do in your path and your journey is incredible as well. So. Well,
we'll see where it takes us, how we get there. It'll zigzag, I'm told.
Thank you so much, mate.